My name is Corey, and I am one of the managing editors of Quilt, a literary publication for and by undergraduate students here at Queens. Right now, we are hiring for our 2025-2026 team, and I want to invite you to apply. We're looking for undergraduate students for our financial team, event planners, illustrators and layout designers, editorial board, copy editors, and outreach team. We are also seeking grad student advisors to work alongside.
To Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine. You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome, everyone. You are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario.
Greetings, friends. My name is Jessica McLean, and I'm here to provide you with some blueprints of disruption. This weekly podcast is dedicated to amplifying the work of activists, examining power structures, and sharing the success stories from the grassroots.
My mom is pondering.
Those sounds, the jets and the scared child, those were recorded not in a conflict zone thousands of miles away, but here in Toronto. Those sounds were from the short but incredibly impactful film Air Show that features actual refugees, a Tamil family that has survived aerial bombardment and genocide, and their genuine reactions to hearing fighter jets zoom overhead. The artist who created the film, Maya Bastian, is here with us today. She's joined by fellow comrades from the Coalition to Demilitarize the Air Show, which, as you can imagine, is part of the larger anti-war movement that is leaving no stone unturned right now, particularly in its quest to get Canada to stop supplying weapons and their components to the Zionist occupation, committing genocide against the Palestinians. This isn't a new campaign. Peace activists, environmentalists, refugee advocates, and even pet lovers have been protesting the air show for years. But there have been shifts, increasing urgency, and a new tool in the form of the Arms Embargo Now report that helps activists contrast the oohs and ahs of the air show with what those killing machines are actually doing in real time. After you're done listening, be sure to watch and share Air Show. You'll find the film's links in the show notes, along with more about the campaign. As always, we kindly ask you to share this episode with someone who would appreciate it. It's your recommendations that really help us grow the audience and make these wonderful connections with activists on the ground. Now let's meet the trio in the studio today.
My name is Maya Bastian. I am a filmmaker and an artist. My background is in conflict journalism. I've spent quite a number of years, over about 15 years, in conflict and post-conflict zones around the world. I make documentaries, I make narrative fiction, I make experimental, and I live in Toronto.
Hi, thanks for inviting me. My name is Charmaine, and I'm an organizer, a more recent one with World Beyond War Toronto, but have been a long time organizer with another group called Known as Legal Toronto. And I also try to pitch in what I can with activist media as an editor with Up in the Ante, which is a social movement journal. And I do a lot of facilitation and training around organizing and direct action. So that's me. And I also live in Toronto.
Hi, my name is Rama Al-Mallah. I'm with the Palestinian Youth Movement, which is a transnational organization for Palestinian and Arab youth in the diaspora. And I'm very happy to be here with you guys tonight.
Now, our audience is likely familiar with the Palestinian Youth Movement and World Beyond War for obvious reasons. We've had representatives of those groups on a few times to talk about the many critical campaigns that you folks have been running. And this is yet another one. But Maya's film, you will have heard sounds from it at the beginning of the show, and to give you a hint, plus the title of the episode, on what we're going to talk about. With all the things that are going on, maybe this might seem like an unsuspecting campaign, perhaps, right? We're going after politicians, banks, you know, climate villains, the list is long, but this is a campaign to demilitarize the air show. Yet we have a rep from World Beyond War, the Palestinian Youth Movement, and an artist, conflict journalist. How are all of these things connected? Maya, you want to take a stab at that?
I think that we all feel very strongly about demilitarizing the air show. I think that we're all deeply invested in humanity and what it means to be human and to be fighting for not just our own rights, but the rights of everyone, because we're connected. And I think that's something that we're being seen more and more now in the world today, is how deeply connected we all are. I think Palestine has really shown us that. What's happening in Gaza and what's happening in the West Bank has really shown us that their struggles are connected to our struggles. And then when you look at something like the air show, it's very plain to see that something very unnecessary and triggering and violent has no place in a city full of refugees and immigrants, has no place in a time where we are seeing the direct results of those warplanes on our screens every single day.
You folks have put together a really good website. It's a debriefer for folks, although they should listen all the way through and then they'll get the gist of it. But let's go over the four main reasons why you folks are working so hard to demilitarize the Canadian National Air Show, which takes place in Toronto every single year. Anybody who lives anywhere near the core in the south of the city, particularly, experiences this air show for at least 4 days over the Labor Day long weekend. The four reasons that we'll go over, you could probably come up with more. I even have like a bonus one in my notes, you know, like there's probably endless reasons to do it. Maybe before we actually get to those, does anyone want to speculate on why they do it? You know, what is the reason that they give you to continue doing this air show despite all the reasons we're going to give them not to?
Yeah, you'll hear many, many reasons about why this air show is so important to some people, including some of the folks who, you know, for spectators. I mean, there's reasons from like just the appreciation of aviation. So, mm-hmm. I mean, aside from, you know, the violent fighter jets, which are only made to bomb people, like they're not made to do loop-de-loops in the sky for you. But, you know, there are like, you know, older planes that acrobatic planes, I guess, that are more for like entertainment and aren't used for war, right? So a lot of the aviation nerds do come out, and they, you know, when we protest this air show, they're just like, you have no appreciation for the science and engineering and the miracle that is aviation. You know, all the way to you know, just a very like taken for granted nationalist, you know, I'm using air quotes, pride around Canada's history and development technology around aviation and the military and our role in the war. So you'll have a wide range of spectators with different interests. And also the number one reason is that it's a long-standing thing with the Canadian National Exhibition, the CNE.
Tradition.
Yeah, it brings in revenue, it brings in tourism, it's good for the city, brings people together. So yeah, we get lots of, we get the nerdy reasons to the nationalist reasons to the money reasons. There's a lot of counters to that we'll be going to. As people have kind of been voicing their concerns over the years about how disruptive it is because it does fly over residential areas, there are many air shows that happen across the world, and a lot of them do happen in more remote places, like in fields, there are stands, you can see those planes, and they're kind of away from any urban areas. There is a really huge question around the Canadian investment, and I mean the government and also private interests in these militarized warplanes, and this is manufacturing consent from the public around where we put our resources. So those are kind of like ways we're trying to intervene. Like, we're definitely not saying you can't enjoy your 1930s plane or...
That's not what they're there for. They're there for the big bombers and the jets and the...
I know. But, one of the planes is, one of the planes that is being used for the forest fires, right? And, there's that. It's one, plane. Those are some of the reasons that we're given.
Okay, well, you've kind of answered one of my questions there, too, where, what would a demilitarized air show look like? And you've listed plenty of planes that are apparently very interesting to people, right?
Totally.
That they could watch without what you folks are focused on. And it's funny that a lot of the reasons that folks will give to have the air show, you're right, you have direct counters towards, particularly the first one, I think, is what we're most focused on. Because, some people will even say it out loud. The value is national pride in all kinds of forms, right? Whatever it is. But it's nationalism. Militarized nationalism. Because we're not proud of our history of airplanes. As far as I know, Canada doesn't hold a very prominent position in the history of airplanes, right? It's not part of our identity. But so one of the main reasons there that you folks list is that it does. One of the reasons to stop it is because it is an ad for militarism. Rama, why is that a bad thing? There's a lot of Canadians that just would not understand why an ad for Canadian military and pride in Canadian military is a bad thing. They don't get it.
I'll actually start from the point that Charmaine made about, manufacturing consent. Seeing F-35 jets in the sky is almost this attempt to normalize these jets and remove them from the context in which they're currently being used, which is the genocide in Gaza. And the Israeli military, one of their main jets that have been used is exactly the F-35 jets that's been used to... drop tons of bombs on the hospitals and the refugee camps and the neighborhoods and the schools and the homes of our people. We're also seeing this in the backdrop of the past 2 years, where the Canadian government has been claiming to have implemented an arms embargo, to have stopped military shipments to the Zionist entity. The recent report from the Arms Embargo Now Coalition, of course, has been able to prove the opposite. We saw what, grassroots organizations are able to achieve. Our politicians are lying to us. We're going to take this in our own hands and prove the opposite. So we're seeing these shipments ongoing. We know Canada is part of the F-35 program. We know there are companies here that are sole suppliers. So we know that there are Canadian made pieces for the F-35 jet that are being sent to the U.S., assembled there, and then sent to Gaza to fuel this genocide. So I think this juxtaposition of like seeing these F-35 jets, you know, in the sky and being normalized in a way, you know, in the backdrop of this genocide, you know, is precisely why it's problematic, essentially, especially as the public we've seen in mass has been, you know, demanding an arms embargo and demanding that these shipments be halted.
Maya, I said it probably wouldn't come up in conversation, but in her film, I spoke to Maya before we started recording, and I just said, like, one of the most disturbing parts of the film or unsettling parts of her film was, although it'll speak to the second point much more, you know, the traumatization of refugees, it was at the end where the family that it focuses on seemed to be part of that normalization process at the end, like an accepting and watching the air show and kind of being okay with it. And that it took a while for me to get to that point, but that felt really unsettling because that felt far more dangerous to have people like not question fighter jets overhead or to not feel fear or, you know, anxiety or responsibility or fucking complicity, right? At this point, when seeing this jets, right? Rather, it's like pride or awe or, you know, all these other emotions that feed into this militarism.
I can speak a little bit to that because when I made the film, you know, I had very strong beliefs and I've always been anti-military. And then at that time in 2016, the person who I was seeing their parents invited me to Oshawa on Remembrance Day to go to a military remembrance. And I was like, I didn't want to do it, but I was dating them and it was a parental invite. So I went, and something that really struck me was interesting because, you know, we go and there's like lists and lists of names of young men who died, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of names of young men who had died. And, you know, I was feeling the weight of that and understanding, okay, this is why we have Remembrance Day, right? But what I realized is that maybe the air show, when it started in 1947, was necessary, right? Because they were commemorating all of the youth that were conscripted and died. But we've come to a place now in society where it's not necessary, where we don't need it, where that time has passed and we're in a new time where we're watching our country bomb other countries, where we're watching not only bomb but support military action in other countries. So to me, it's like we've changed as a society. We're much more diverse. We have different needs and interests. And I think something like the air show needs to account for and accommodate for that. And the city needs to understand that.
But that's also why it is so necessary from the state's perspective, because we are moving away from that mentality. And you folks are, like, from World Beyond War, issuing reports that are having Canadians start to sit uncomfortably with their militarism and what that actually means, because in their minds it's meant peacekeeping for so long, right? That's what they've been taught in school. But now they're facing a completely different picture, that in fact that military that they've been celebrating all of this time and that industry that they seem to be proud of being involved in, right, the American military industrial complex, is responsible for the worst of the worst. And that is very uncomfortable, right? So the more folks can still look at that F-35, and I keep bringing this up because it really bothered me. You know, you have like the most progressive option out there, like the NDP electorally, and Jagmeet's response to like uproar about the F-35s being bought from the Americans was that we should just make them here ourselves. You know, like the idea of that just being okay, that being a genuine way to drum up the economy, is just like been normalized right across the political spectrum. So you folks, you know, you have your work cut out for you. I this isn't to deter you at all. It's just a comment on how entrenched and ratchet up the Liberals seem to be on building a elbows up kind of mighty Canadian image.
It's always been, you know, the scenario where you, if you criticize anything about, you know, the military, you know, it's like, you know, you farted in a room. Like, people are just like, why? Like, you know, why do you have to be such a, you know, naysayer about something you should have pride about? And so, yeah, you're right. It's like this kind of common sense, unquestionable. And this isn't just us in Canada. I feel like everyone around the world who fights for demilitarization to stop, you know, the growth of armies has always faced that, like, you know, you're not a patriot. In fact, you're, what you're saying is treasonous. So I think, like, that is not new, but this particular political moment is really important because we have a new Liberal prime minister. And like the Liberals kind of come from this, like, apparently give lip service to, like, you know, Canada as a peacekeeping country. We, you know, want to put resources elsewhere. We now have a prime minister that has committed to, you know, 2%, meaning the 2% mark of our military spending to meet the NATO requirement, which is all imaginary. There is actually no logical, like, why 2%? Why the GDP? Like, just across the board, they, like, that's the requirement.
He's entertaining 5%.
And yeah, he wants 5% to 2035, which is amounts to, you know, billions of dollars. And what people might not know is that national defense is the fourth top spending expenditure of the government spending, the federal government spending, you know, above healthcare, above education, above Indigenous services, above, you know, I mean, you list all of it. And for what, right? It's just like this very, again, manufactured need that we somehow need a strong military, and now even a stronger one that even exceeds what Canada spent, you know, in terms of, like, comparing it to World War II. So it's just egregious. And so this is a sort of political moment that we are now confronting this, you know, one local air show, which is an advertisement. Also the controversy of Canada buying these jets, which has been stalled because it's just like, it's been stalled because it's going to be a lot more money than I thought. And we're saying that these critiques are nowhere, right? Like, we are basically letting Lockheed Martin have free airspace across our skies for 4 days to wow, quote unquote, wow people with their killing machines during a moment where this is actually a big debate, right? Where we're actually talking about a crisis in, you know, cost of living. We're going to be expecting strikes in the education sector. And so to have this amount of money being placed into defense and military is just egregious. And so, yeah, I think the moment right now is really pivotal that people start, you know, like, at least like, just we need to disrupt that for sure.
For years, folks have been trying to stop the air show or demilitarize it. And one of the main points is beautifully and painfully depicted in Maya's film, and that it traumatizes folks who have especially experienced aerial bombardment. Maya, how long ago did you make that film again?
I made it in 2016.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about the film and why it was important to really genuinely show that impact to people? And then maybe we can talk about, you know, why 10 years later that isn't important enough for city council or whatnot to have truly taken these objections into advisement.
Yeah, I mean, I made the film because in 2000, I'm Tamil, Sri Lankan, and in 2009, there was a genocide of Tamil people by the Sri Lankan state. And I had been going to Sri Lanka from that time onwards, and I had seen the devastation of what bombing does, what aerial bombardment can do. And one of the times I went, I came back and the air show happened, and I had PTSD and I was frozen. I was frozen in the streets. I was I never experienced aerial bombardment in a situation where I was unsafe, but I heard it and I saw the effects of it. So I just realized that it was so unnecessary. And then I moved to Parkdale. And when I moved to Parkdale a decade ago, it's full of immigrants, it's full of refugees, and those planes go over and I was watching people jump into bushes. And I went and spoke to refugee counselors and asked them if they prepare their clients. And they were like, no, we don't tell them about the air show. Why would we? Which was such a strange, like, dissonance. And so that kind of just started me, like, on this journey of, okay, I want to make a film. I didn't have any money. I didn't have any support. But as soon as I started writing this and telling people what I wanted to do, so many people were like, yes, I will help you, because they all felt the same. And it started to, I started to realize that most people in the city don't like the air show. It's most people that come from out that that's what I've seen. So yeah. And then we made the film, and it was, I think it's, I mentioned it to you earlier that it's, the father and daughter in the film are refugees who have experienced aerial bombardment, and we shot it during the air show. And they had never experienced the air show before. So it was a really interesting experiment. And, you know, I held a lot of space for them. The first time one of the planes flew over, I had given them the warning. They didn't think it was going to be as realistic to that their experience as it was. And so the first time the planes flew over, the daughter jumped into the father's arms and screamed, and we stopped the cameras. And I talked to them, and the father for the rest of the shoot kept saying to me, why is it necessary? Why is it necessary? That's all he kept saying over and over again, with this look of complete shock on his face. So it felt, yeah, it felt really important. And at that time it hit kind of the cultural zeitgeist, and a lot of press happened. There's a lot of, people were really, there was huge debates online, and it was a big thing. And I got, as I mentioned, I got death threats. I got people very angry that I was being anti-Canadian. People kept saying, like, why don't you go back where you came from? And I'm like, well, I was born here. So herein lies the problem. So yeah, I do feel it was, you know, at that time it felt important. It feels even more important now. And I think it's a testament to the story and to what I was trying to say, that every year it gets like thousands of views and people feel affected by the film, because it's never going away, right? Like, we're still facing this. And the fact that we have to see the devastation every day of what these airplanes do, and that we're still promoting them, is like mind-boggling. It makes no sense to any rational person. It makes no sense that we're watching this happen, and yet the city continues to promote it. And there was a moment, like, on the air show website, for many years it was like, loud, 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 it's gonna be loud, loud, loud. And then during the time, I think during my film, and there was a lot of other people speaking up, and there was a bunch of articles about it, they changed that, and they had a little disclaimer that said, we are aware that this air show may cause X, Y, and Z to people and whatever. And I don't know what it's like now, but apparently, you know, they really don't care. Like, it's really not about what the people want. And at the time when I, this is my last point, but at the time when I was doing the press, people kept saying, do you want to cancel the air show? And because I was on, you know, national press, I didn't want to take a hardline view. And so I said, no, but why does it have to be over the city? It does not. It started in Downsview Park. It could be somewhere else. I get that, you know, we're now talking about demilitarization, which I fully support. But at that time I was like, there's no reason for it to fly over a city full of immigrants and a city full of people who have had experiences such as these. So, you know, it doesn't make any sense to me. And I don't think it should make any sense to any rational person.
No, as we go through the reasons why not, like, they're countless. They're countless. And I think, to your point, you know, whether you move it or demilitarize it or stop it, the point is the same. Like, you're forcefully subjecting people to it when you hold it over the city, not just the nationalism, but the dangers, right? And then the trauma that will affect not just people that have experienced what you described.
There's no other air show in the world that I could find that's held over a major metropolitan city. There's no. They're all in airfields.
I mean, I think it also goes, like, beyond this air show. Like, this air show is, like, one, you know, element of complicity and, like, attempt to normalize this. But we're talking about, like, you know, our institutions and our pension funds being invested in weapons manufacturers. We're talking about, like, research partnerships on our university campuses that are, you know, making research prototypes to improve, you know, missiles and weapons. So this is, like, one element of like, you know, this broader complicity that we're seeing in Canada. And we've seen, you know, the magnitude of this genocide. And for sure, like the scenes and the videos that come out of Gaza are, you know, like incomprehensible at this point. They're sights that I don't think anyone has ever been able to see, especially now with the starvation. But we've seen like the magnitude of this genocide push the Canadian public and, you know, specifically also the Palestinian and Arab diaspora, you know, to take to the streets, you know, week after week in mass numbers, demanding an arms embargo and demanding an end to Canadian complicity. We've seen the same, you know, on like the student side, demanding divestment, demanding an end to these research partnerships. So we're seeing, you know, the magnitude of this genocide, like, galvanize the masses even more, and demand like that all of these different elements of complicity are halted, essentially. The recent report that came out is, I think, very important because it was a testament to this commitment from the masses to hold our government accountable, and is now being used as a tool of accountability, but also, you know, like creating a crisis for the government and ensuring that their support, the Zionist entity, is not like an easy thing to maintain. It's a difficult and untenable thing to maintain. And I think like sharpening the contradictions around like things like this air show is, you know, part of this process of like creating a crisis and making sure that all of these things are always highlighted, that we're sharpening these contradictions, and showing the juxtaposition of, you know, these weapons being made in our backyards and flown over our cities, while they're also being sent to fuel and sustain a genocide. And I think, like, for sure we have a long way to go in demanding an arms embargo, but we're starting to see, you know, the fruits of this pressure. You know, yesterday, Ottawa-based Kalyan, who was revealed to be shipping GPS antennas to Elbit Systems, actually said that they will be, you know, halting shipments. So we're seeing these victories coming, these material wins for the arms embargo campaign and the movement come as well. And yeah, like, we're seeing that this mass pressure does work. We just need to maintain it.
What great timing to have that report while you're questioning, you know, the presence of F-35s in the sky. I think Rama just, you know, explained it perfectly, the way that we make them in all the small towns around here, then fly them over the skies and then ship them abroad. And I think, yeah, the fruits of the movement and the cooperation are evident here too, right? Watching all of this collaboration happening, and to hit every pressure point imaginable, right? Even the air show, even, you know, that Canadian tradition of the CNE, how dare you? It kind of goes along with Remembrance Day, Charmaine, like that, when you were talking, I was like, yeah, and Maya as well. Like, that's another day that just like, people don't like you making those contradictions, but they're like the perfect times to do it, right? There are other reasons listed on the website and that have been given to officials. I don't want to spend too much time on them because I do want to talk about how the campaign is working. And they seem to, like, no offense, but they seem to pale in comparison to what we're talking about of, like, entrenching militarism and contributing to a genocide. But, like, you know, pets, everyone's always like pets, fireworks and all of that jazz. Like it has impact to the environment, right? To the wildlife, to folks' pets and children who don't understand what's happening. It's a waste of fucking money, right? It disrupts the community in so many ways. Like all that revenue they talk about at the waterfront, I just feel traffic. Surely if you live in Parkdale, like there's just cars parked on every lawn everywhere. It's just like, it's not a good place. It doesn't feel like community during the CNE in general, but on Labor Day weekend is something else down there. But yeah, so like a laundry list has been presented to City Council, right? I'm sure you've had petitions with thousands of signatures, right? Like over the years, we have just generated so much evidence and public sentiment. There seemed to be a little bit of movement. I'm teasing you though, right? Like, Charmaine, I'm looking at Charmaine here in the camera. She feels me looking at her. I don't know, but Olivia Chow, right? The most progressive mayor we've ever had. Everyone knows, my whole audience knows I'm being facetious. I don't need scare quotes. So she heard you, right? And she said she would take these objections into advisement. Was there any evidence that city council has heard or seen Maya's film, perhaps? Maybe that should be a mandatory screening, or they heard the many, many campaigns that have already been waged so far. Was there any adjustment, any glimmer of hope this year as it shaped up?
Yeah, I mean, I can't offer proof that any of that's been heard or taken into account. I think Olivia Chow did release like a statement just being like, hey, like, I know this can upset people and your pets, so just like take care. Kind of like it was like a heat warning, you know, or something. And so, what we're asking, our demand right now, if you go to the website, is to submit a note or an email to your local city councilor around this and keep the pressure up. Yeah. Get these, you know, militarized, loud, killing machines out of the sky. But Olivia Chow has been, a consistent disappointment around this, you know, especially around organizing around Gaza. Like, she's come out, you know, comparing the protests to like supporting Hamas, and like has never been supportive and never wanted to take meetings with, you know, the movement. So I don't expect her to be on the right side of history with this one, but you know, this is a hard campaign to organize around. You know, a lot of people who might be against it. It's really weird to kind of like confront people who are very supportive, especially pro-military, you know, folks, or pro-nationalist folks. It's a little scary that, you know, it's obviously like maybe some, they're not the audience we want, but even if we're just like leafleting with like facts about military spending and the impacts, you know, this is a really hard issue to organize around, because it's so embedded, you know? And so I think, the city council thing is like kind of like one tactic. Public awareness is another, you know, and also just like providing educationals. Also just maybe creating our own cultural space, like maybe creating a space where we like talk about like what a world of peace and justice would look like. These are all different tactics that we all need to engage in. But I will say, when it comes year after year with the air show, I feel like a lot of people are just kind of like, okay, either I'll leave town or I'll just like, you know, get earplugs and put up with it, because it's 4 days and it's kind of like, it feels like, you know, the corporations and the CNE just will win out every time, right? Like, they have way more power. So it's a campaign that we need to keep building year after year, and having and showcasing different forms of intervention, like this documentary, you know, like the voices of those impacted, and keep building that. But it's really hard because of just how embedded this idea that like, if you want freedom, you need these, you know, fighter jets. If you want democracy, you need a strong army. It can be intimidating, like for experienced organizers, it's very intimidating to go into this foreign and try and talk to people. You know, they just think you are like this treasonous, you know, jerk, and you know, so you just hear everything, like, if you don't like it, get out of the country, like that stuff, you know? So there's definitely like city councilors on the left who are sympathetic.
We have city councilors on the left.
That we feel...
Sorry.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Some on the left that might be sympathetic, but it's an issue that I feel like many don't want to just take up, you know? And for sure, I know if Olivia Chow was like, oh yeah, I'll look at like maybe moving the CNE, I'm sure she can anticipate the backlash, you know, around it. Unfortunately, she might have taken into consideration, but the air show's still on for this year. But we can always try for next year, right?
Well, it made me think of the Giller Prize and the tactics that Artists Against the War on Gaza and Writers Against the War on Gaza. I'm probably getting some of their acronyms wrong, but they're... mantra, so to speak, when approaching this was like, let us turn their stage into our platform. So whenever Scotiabank tries to pretend they're like part of the Canadian fabric and do this, you know, benefactors of literature, we will be there to remind them of the contradictions of that, of what, where their funds go. And it became like just a marketing nightmare for Scotiabank to spend all this money to put on these things that were supposed to build up their brand. But activists took all of those opportunities to kind of tear down the brand a bit. And eventually they had to adjust their tactics. So may you be able to turn this stage, whether you get it canceled or not, if they want to fly these jets over, then you can say, fine. You see these jets? Here's what they do. Here's what they really do. Here is who's making them. Here's the address to find that factory that's sending components. Here's where they're being shipped from. You know, like, it does provide that backdrop to make those contradictions in the meantime, right? Until we can do better than flying F-35s over for entertainment purposes. Because that actually was quite successful. But yeah, it's like that institution, not just the air show, but the CNE. And then anytime you got a canvas on a hard topic where there's like families, where people feel like they should be totally insulated from politics, is like, even sometimes you show up at a farmer's market and people are like, can't you leave me alone? Like, as though there's like political spheres you enter and you can be engaged on politics. Otherwise, like, they're going in for $50 corn dogs and they do not want to be reminded of the role Canada plays, right? Like, it's just not today, people. So I get, on top of having to deal with, you know, folks who say things like Canadians died for our charter rights, they're never fun to deal with.
Yeah. And also the links to like, this is family friendly, I'm here with my kids, like the linking of like, you know, having a heteronormative family and joining this army thing. It's just like over and over again, the messaging of like what is considered value, you know? And it's a space that reproduces a lot of racism, right? So if you're not part of that, if you are, you know, like, I don't have to remind listeners, just a few years ago, you know, our previous premier said refugees are welcome. There was an election where Syria was actually a very big political struggle, right? To like bring to support more Syrian refugees to enter, because we saw a racist system that didn't prioritize refugees of color. And we see that now with doing anything that's like anti-military, especially with the air show, right? Like, those people should be lucky they're here. If they don't like it, they should leave. Like, these racist narratives just come out of everyday, you know, people, like it's nothing. And yeah, just kind of, I don't mind the challenge. Like, I'm not saying like, we should step away from that. But what I'm trying to get down to listeners is that we all need to participate in this, like, cultural and political shift to talk about what, like, where the money is going and what it's doing and the debt it's creating and how that is purposely and systemically, like, shielded from us, right? Like, they don't fly an F jet and then after have a giant image of like, hey, here's what the jet does, right, across the sky. Now, if I had the money, and that would be a really great culture jamming moment, I would totally do that. I would show those images as much as I can. For now, we just have our printers in our union offices, or wherever we do our printing, and just try and poster the hell out of the area to let people know.
So on top of the campaign that you have for folks to, which will be linked in the show notes, to contact their city councilors, do you suggest folks outside the city, is there anywhere for them to place pressure? Obviously having the conversations that you're talking about, like the broader conversations, but, you know, the CNE, the Canadian National Exhibition, should they be hearing from folks saying, you know what, I would still come if there's no air show. That doesn't need to be an integral part of the exhibition.
I mean, feel free for anyone to jump in. Like, I think this is very much linked to the arms embargo campaign that we have an arms embargo starting, and yet we have public money going towards showcasing and advertising jets and weapons that are massacring people right now. So for me, all roads lead to the arms embargo and making links to how much these private corporations and also governments are profiting off of the genocide. So definitely go to the arms embargo website and all the demands there. This is one focal point in Toronto, but it is really much linked to the arms embargo campaign.
Maya or Rema, is there anything that you'd like to add before we kind of sign off?
My film is free to watch. It's online on Vimeo. So if anybody wants to see it, I think it's a dramatization. It hits pretty heavy. I think it's a good way to reach people that maybe don't understand, because it's not a documentary, right? Like, so it's kind of entertainment, but it's entertainment with a purpose. So if there's people in your life that don't understand why demilitarizing the air show is important, show them the film.
And it's 8 minutes. So do you have time to watch it? Your friends you share it with, they have time to watch it. Rama, is there anything that you want to leave us with?
Yeah, I mean, just like a couple of words, I guess, but honestly, just calling on people to stay mobilized and stay organized. You know, it's been 2 years since this genocide, but it's important for us to, you know, to stay organized and keep the pressure up.
I thank you all, not just for coming on the show and spending your time and energy like sharing with the audience, but for doing what you're doing on the ground, especially, and for what you're contributing to our communities. I very, very much appreciate it. You enjoy your day.
Thanks, Jessa.
That is a wrap on another episode of Blueprints of Disruption. Thank you for joining us.
In Gaza, health officials are reporting an additional 10 deaths due to starvation in the past day, including 2 children. This brings the total number of starvation-related deaths in Gaza due to Israel's indiscriminate blockade to 313, nearly 120 of whom are children. Israeli attacks continue across the besieged strip as Israel's military forces intensify an offensive in Gaza City, where Israeli tanks and warplanes have leveled entire blocks, destroying family homes. Gaza officials say Israeli strikes have killed at least 75 people in the past 24 hours, including 18 Palestinians killed seeking food. Meanwhile, more Palestinian families have been forced to flee Gaza City due to the relentless Israeli shelling.
Where is the south? Even if we die, we won't go to the south of Gaza. The south is worse than here. There is no safety here or there. It is all the same.
This all comes as Human Rights Watch says U.S. military personnel and contractors can be held liable for Israeli war crimes committed in Gaza for, quote, providing intelligence for Israeli strikes and conducting extensive coordination and planning, unquote. Today, Trump is set to chair a White House meeting on a comprehensive plan for managing post-war Gaza. For more, we go to Gaza, where we're joined by Dr. Ahmed Al-Farah. He's the head of pediatrics at Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis. First of all, our condolences on this latest attack on Nasser Hospital. The world has recoiled in outrage this weekend with the killing of 5 journalists, as well as healthcare workers and civil defense workers who ran to the aid of the Reuters journalist who had been putting up a live stream. Can you explain what you understood happened and the Israeli response, calling it a tragic mishap, this double tap strike?
Okay, thank you for having me, my friend and my colleagues. First, 2 days ago, nearly at 10:20 in the morning, while I was in my office while examining a case, my colleague sent it for me for consultation. And I put the stethoscope in my ears. Suddenly, we heard a very loud voice. It's like something extreme voice and a very loud voice, which is move the building that we are standing or sitting in it. We were completely confused. Even the mother that I was examining, her child has syncopal attack and fainting, and we were confused to treat the mother or to continue examining the patient or to go downstairs and to see what's happening. Later on, we discovered that there were a bomb tank was directed to the external stairs of El Yassin building. You know, El Yassin building, it is the main building of Nasser Medical Complex. It is belongs to the operation theater. It belongs to, it contains also the ICUs. It contains also the lab and the reception room. All the main department in Nasser Medical Complex are in El Yassin building. This stair is outstairs. It is like emergency stairs. The top of that stairs is they have some area in the fourth floor. This area is the most powerful for a SIM card. You know, the journalists are using SIM cards for covering their events, for documented their events, and sent that for their agencies. The first journalist, whose name is Hussam, was there, and he was covering the and documented his material and sent by the ASIM card to that area, but he was targeted. Later on, the occupational forces says that they are targeting something like a camera. Okay, okay, I understand that you want to damage the camera. Why you are killing the people? You are highly technique. You have high technique. You have air drone. You have the snipers. You have everything. You can shoot the camera. Okay. You can evacuate. You can tell the administration of Nasser Medical Complex evacuate that camera with the journalist from that area. What I mean that the first attack was double attack. The first attack is for the external stairs of El Yassin building, and in the same time there were another attack for the balcony of El Yassin building in the fourth floor. In that balcony there were doctors. There are medical students in the sixth year of faculty of Al Azhar University, which is local university, and they are studying medicine, and they were discussing the cases of intensive care unit with their colleagues. So a doctor was executed, unfortunately, and Hussam, the journalist, also was executed, and also his assistant, the photographer, was severely injured. We, when we hear the voice, all the hospital, all the journalists, all the rescue team, they go upstairs to save their colleagues. You know, we are, as Palestinian, we are something like sympathy with the injured patient. Everyone tried to help. Everyone, they are emotionally, highly emotion to help. Okay, so the rescue team is upstairs. The journalists are upstairs. When they are collecting and they try to make rescue or to do resuscitation and to do evacuation for the injured patient, unfortunately, another bomb tank came and it make a massacre there. There were nearly 18 persons were killed, five from them journalists, four in this attack and one in the previous attack. Also, three or four guys from the security guys of the hospital, civil defense also were killed, and the doctor were killed, and some person who want to help also were killed. So again, this is a full crime. This deliberate compound attack constitutes a calculated trap aimed at targeting rescue team. This is unbelievable. The journalist, I think this is for silencing witnesses and undermining the channel of survival for anyone to tell what's happening there. So it is unbelievable to talk about that we want the camera. If you want the camera, why you did the second attack? If you want to someone that you are talking, that someone is belongs to us. All the journalists are belongs to Associated Press, NBC, American Channel, for Reuters, for Palestine. All of them, they are known for everyone. Why you did this massacre for them? It's unbelievable. It's incredible. It crosses all the red lines. But I will understand that this is normal, because this is the number of 245 journalists were killed since the beginning of the war. I can understand that one of them...
Dr. Alfana, yes. I wanted to ask you, in addition to the people being killed by the shelling and the bombing of the Israelis, there are the reports of the increasing number of dead from famine and starvation, over 300 Palestinians now. What is the condition of the, well, the Israelis are saying that there's plenty of food, and it's just Hamas is stealing it. Could you respond to this question of the food situation? Situation and starvation that you're witnessing in Gaza?
According to the famine and severe acute malnutrition, my friend, we have to understand some critical points. First, that Gaza Strip needs 600 trucks every day to be fully feeding, fully medical supplies for everything. The number of trucks that coming nowadays is just 50 trucks. This is the first thing. Second, Gaza Strip is closing the closed borders since the last March. We are talking about 5 months. So if you need to recompensate or compensate the quantity, so you have to more trucks to be get in. The third, and this is the most important one, and we want the audience and everyone watching us to understand that the Israeli forces ask the trucks, the 50 trucks, to come inside area that belongs to them, okay? And they put it for the gangs and for someone to get inside. It's not delivered for the NGOs, for UNRWA, for UNICEF. And when? Please, and when someone try to protect that trucks and try to deliver it for UNRWA or for UNICEF, they targeting it by air drone. This is like chaos engineering. Among the media, the trucks are coming inside Gaza, and you see the flowers. Someone is holding the flower, but this is actually like a sand in the eye. This is not a solution and not a final result for to end that that famine and that severe acute malnutrition. So I think that we will see a number of increasing of severe acute malnutrition. According to the media of Israel, that they are talking about someone is stealing Hamas or stealing, this is something ended, and everyone knows that all that food will come to the UNICEF or UNRWA and will be distributed according to the civilian record, according to the identity card for everyone. Everyone will receive his food, and everyone will receive his quantity that it is dealing with him with morality and with humanity. The distribution that they are using with the GHF and the method that they are using with it, it is dealing with the Palestinian, sorry for explanation and for the expression, like an animals. It is unbelievable. I am a doctor. I am 53 years ago. I will never go to the GHF because I'm unable to go there. And if I go there, I afraid to get back as a body or someone, my son or my daughter. So, my friend, we will see, and we expect to see a lot of cases of severe acute malnutrition every day. We received either cases is more and more aggressive, and every day or day by day we receive someone who come with his son who was arrested and died in the evacuated area to the hospital.
Dr. Ahmed Alfara, I want to thank you so much for being with us, head of pediatrics at Nasser Hospital, where he's speaking to us from in Khan Yunis. He himself has been displaced twice, now lives in a tent.
that's it for us for today. You were listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario.